And welcome back to The People's Game. I'm Alan Minsky.
This is Pablo Morales.
And in studio with us is the host of KPFK Radio's Page to Pantry, Nikki Gallucci.
Hey, everybody.
And Nikki Gallucci was born and raised in Nigeria.
Yes.
And before we get to Nigeria, who opens their tournament tomorrow against Argentina, very competitive, exciting match. Let me first ask Nikki, though, this general question. First World Cup game ever for the finals in Africa today. Did you catch it? And what do you make of that fantastic event?
Well, of course, it's always a phenomenal sight. Everybody saw Desmond Tutu dancing. That's the visual that you can take out of that. And that's the ebullience of the African continent. And really, soccer embodies the whole energy of the continent. And no matter what's going on, no matter what wars are being fought and what political rivalries are going on, soccer is the thing that brings nations together, that brings people together, that brings warring tribes together. And so it brings a continent together also when the different countries are, at loggerheads. And so it's a great moment in history for Africa, no doubt.
Then turning directly to Nigeria, which again takes the field tomorrow, soccer's place within Nigeria. It's as big there as anywhere, right?
Oh, yeah. Are you kidding? That's the soul of Nigeria. I mean, probably bigger than oil. Definitely. Every little kid, even if they don't have a ball, they're kicking a can or whatever, Soccer is the way that, you live and you breathe. And people who don't have TVs are listening on the radio. People are at their neighbors' houses, neighbors that you may not talk to otherwise. And, soccer brings them together. Soccer is the way. Presidents put money into the soccer teams. It could be last minute. It could be whatever. Because if the team wins, you're a great president. The team loses, I don't know about this administration. It kind of goes that way. So soccer is big.
Well, now, I don't know how many people know this. Of course, they might know that there's six countries from Africa in this World Cup. Of the other five non-Nigerian countries, you add their populations up, and it still falls short of Nigeria. And with Nigeria having a very powerful performance at the 1994 World Cup, the one here in the United States, there's really been expectation, given the size of the country, the passion for soccer, that Nigeria would be the first side to really challenge for a World Cup championship. And yet, in the last few World Cups, including recently, it hasn't really come to fruition for Nigeria. So how are expectations in the country for 2010?
Well, it's an excellent question that you've asked, and it's really indicative of the sports organization within the country. The fact that a lot of talented young players are recruited very early to the European teams. Mm-hmm. And then when they want to come back to play in Nigeria, they want XYZ done for them, and the country can't really come up with that, or they want a certain coach, and there's a different coach that's brought for them, or the different countries where they are, they've naturalized. So you'll see some Nigerian players playing in different European countries, etc. So that really depletes the talent, the soccer talent in Nigeria, and I think that's really happened. And a lot of times when it's time to go to the world stage, sometimes not the best players coming up are really put together. It becomes, oh my gosh, I want my uncle or my brother's son or whatever to be the one there. So in the years where you see that happening in Nigeria, it affects the play.
Yeah, well, it's interesting that in Africa and like some other smaller places in the world as well, where the players are actually bigger than the teams. I mean, you look at Ivory Coast and everyone knows Drogba,
right?
But can they name three or four other players on that team if they don't watch the Premier League or the French League that much? Mm-hmm. It's indicative of teams like Nigeria that would normally have such a great lineage with Olympic victories, gold medals,
right,
and having amazing victories in 94 over Argentina, who they're playing tomorrow, that you would think that that lineage would continue. But what I think what happens, and you alluded to this, is that the players get bigger than the team, and therefore you have a certain amount of inter-squad corruption, if I can use that word. When you said pick the coach, I mean, that happens so often in African football, happening just before the World Cup in this term.
The other thing is, what time do you get all these players together? Even if you're able to bring them from all the different teams, are you getting them together 2 weeks beforehand? and they all of a sudden supposed to get used to each other in the 2 weeks. That's always been an issue as well with the soccer drain, I call it, not the brain drain.
Well, there are a number of very familiar global stars. Nobody who's in the absolute upper rung like a Drogba or a Michael Essien, who unfortunately is missing the tournament for Ghana on this Nigerian side, but some very big prominent international names. For me, however, though, the most important player for this year's team, had he been able to play, would have been John Obi Mikel. In fact, I think he scored the final goal. If Nigeria really struggled to qualify. They really relied, I believe, on Mozambique knocking off Tunisia to get in. But even in that, it was Obi Mikel who scored a goal against Tunisia that even allowed them to be in it going into the final round of games and qualifying. But Mikel, who plays for Chelsea, is a great player there. But on Nigeria in qualifying, they were allowing him to really take a much larger role than he gets to on Chelsea, and he was really stepping up to it. So it's a big loss for the side, but there still is the talent there. And my sense is that they will go through the group stage.
I think the weather is an issue for us.
Oh, yeah.
No one talks about this. It's hot. I mean, you should see when we put on sweaters in Nigeria, okay? People will be in their bikinis over here. And in South Africa right now, it's kind of like winter. It's cold, okay? Right. And I remember a couple of years ago, I think it was in, when they were playing in Asia, and they had some minutes where they let, you know, the poor South Americans kind of cool off and drink cold water. Nigerians are like, what's going on? What are we stopping for? Let's get this action rolling. Are there going to be heaters on the sideline for the Nigerian players to warm up, okay, and get their blood going to play? You laugh about it. It's a problem.
Yeah. Well, it's true that I remember when they did so well in 94, they were down in Dallas, I believe,
that's right,
and it was so damn hot and the team really stepped up. But I do think the team will be made up almost exclusively of players. Again, there are so many Nigerian players in Europe, and I think this side will be largely, almost entirely made up of players who play in Europe who will have gone through the European winter. Of course, they will have just gone into the European summer, so their bodies may not be adjusted back. But, you know, it's true that an advantage is lost, and it could prove a disadvantage.
Absolutely. Yeah. You know, I definitely am rooting for heaters on the sideline.
Well, it's also true that, as we all know, the nations develop their own national styles, and this is suited for the Dutch and the English style to be in the winter. And as this develops down in Nigeria, this certainly isn't climate that is suited to that style.
But I also think you shouldn't underestimate the amount of support that the local South
right.
Africans are going to give to Nigeria and hopefully every African nation that is participating right now. And that'll help to have that 12th man.
Right, and tomorrow's game is certainly the whole world will be watching because everybody wants to know what's up with Argentina. Leo Messi's generally is called the top player in the world right now. The whole Maradona circus is there. In Nigeria, the second African side to take the field in the first African World Cup finals. So it's going to be a great game.
I think it's going to be – it's a tough matchup for us, but hopefully the Golden Eagles will soar tomorrow.
There we go. Well, thank you so much, Nikki Gallucci, for joining us, host of Page to Pantry on KPFK Radio, and enjoy the match tomorrow.
Great. Thank you for having me.
This is Alan Minsky, and you're listening to The People's Game, Pacifica Radio's 2010 World Cup Soccer Show. Argentina, Leo Messi, Diego Maradona, certainly one of the highest profile stories in the 2010 World Cup. And right now I'm joined by Leo Paz. He is a Los Angeles-based Argentinian journalist. Welcome, Leo, to the People's Game.
Good to be here with you, Alan.
Well, this team, people really don't know what to expect. Either it's just going to take the tournament by storm, it's going to produce spectacular soccer, or it's going to implode in some kind of car, train wreck, plane wreck disaster. What do you think right now? Is this team, has it come together? It hadn't come together in South American qualifying for the World Cup. Has it come together now?
Well, I think, you know, the World Cup is a very particular tournament. Usually the teams that do better come together during the World Cup. You know, there's been a lot of cases in World Cup history where teams who were doing fabulous previous to the World Cup bombed out during the tournament and just went home early. You know, this has been the case with notably Argentina in 2002, France the same that year, you know, coming from being the world champions. They went out in the first phase. So anything can happen. That's been the norm in the World Cup, you know. For instance, in the last World Cup, Argentina was actually playing pretty decent. You know, they did some marvelous work, especially in the game against Serbia. But they were not able to conquer Germany when they were locals, and that really did them in. But this World Cup, the difference with the previous Argentinian teams is that I think there's a lot more, you know, hunger for winning and for glory than previous World Cups. This is a young team with a few veterans in it, you know, like Veron. If I can notice any difference in the way they've been talking to the press, and from what we can see from the trainings on the various reports, is that they're really hungry for glory. They're you know, it's been 24 years since Argentina has won the World Cup, but if anything can be said for Maradona as a coach, is that he's a great motivator. The guys in the Argentina team are going to go all out tomorrow, I mean, and the rest of the World Cup from what we can see. So tactically, it's not going to be a revolutionary tactic that they're going to play, but they're going to give it their all. I can see from what they've been saying that they're going to be going all out.
I'm simply going to throw you the softest softball question in the history of journalism. How big is soccer in Argentina? I mean, is it singularly the most important thing in the country, or is it still polo?
Well, polo is a very elite sport. You know, there's a few, you know, big land-owning families that play that. But soccer is by far, you know, the passion for Argentines. You know, every 4 years, the whole country comes together. It's a national pastime on a weekly basis. But during the World Cup, it's too special because there's not the infighting caused by the clubs in rivalry that is normal between World Cups. The whole country just pulls together. You know, people are on the, you know, different cafes, bars, restaurants, just glued to the TV at, you know, families' homes. The streets are deserted, of course, so there's hardly any traffic. I mean, it's huge. Well, and if Argentina wins, you know, the capital, you know, the obelisco, the monument there, it's going to be flooded. People are going to be celebrating for on end.
Obviously, Leo Messi is probably the player who is going to get as much, if not more, attention than any player in the world. And perhaps the only thing that is deflecting the attention away from him is the fact that Diego Maradona is his coach. So one question, finally, what is being said in the Argentinian press about how the two men themselves actually get along?
From what I can see from the press, they've the comparison has been started, you know, in the last couple of years, really.
Allow me to editorialize. I don't see it yet for Messi. He's a spectacular, spectacular player on the ball, running at players. He seems to be able to be moving forward at full pace and then make a perpendicular move and yet not break stride. It's a phenomenal effect. But I don't yet see him, you know, unless he shines and takes this team to the title, I don't see him in the class yet. And doesn't really belong in the argument along with Pelé and Maradona. I think he's propelled in that all too soon. Your thoughts?
You're right in the sense that he's has everything to show for the national team so far. Although, you know, you could argue that winning the under-20 championship with Argentina and the Olympics has been it's somewhat commendable. But, of course, the major Argentina national team is what every Argentine player can aspire to reaching the glory, is, you know, big champions of Argentina, and that's the what every Argentine player aspires to, and that's what Messi needs to come forth and come, you know, to really shine in the moments where he's needed, especially when the team, you know, is trailing or it seems like they're not pulling together enough. That's when you need to see the extra pull that's going to take the team to victory. That's what Messi needs to show. And, you know, he doesn't want to be like Maradona. He's said, you know, in numerous interviews that he's not like Diego. It's his idol. That's his idol. At the same time, Maradona has said that he's never seen a player like Messi. So, you know, they both, Maradona is trying to get the best out of Messi, and Messi realizes that he's never going to be like Diego, but at the same time, he knows that this is his time, and that the whole country is pulling for him, and they want him to succeed.
Certainly, Leo Messi is a joy to watch. If you are a soccer fan looking for spectacular beauty on the field of play. Leo Messi right now is certainly the first place to go to, and it should be fun as anything tomorrow. So, Leo, Paz, enjoy the game tomorrow, and we'll talk to you throughout the tournament here on The People's Game.
Great. Thank you, Alan.
Alan Minsky here with my co-host,
Pablo Morales.
And this is The People's Game, and right now we're going to focus, Pablo and myself, on Team USA that takes the field against England. Pablo certainly follows this team with a great degree of focus, and what do you expect tomorrow?
Well, I expect tomorrow a great game, a focus game, a team game. The only question is whether or not they make a lot of mistakes in the defense that open up for Rooney, particularly.
Right.
Maybe an outside shot from, you know, Lampard or Gerrard, right. But the only real big story about the United States in the World Cup is that we are the only soccer culture in the world that does not have soccer as its primary sport.
Mm.
Okay. So we started from the absolute wilderness in 1990 when we first qualified for our first modern World Cup in Italy. And since then, the program, the United States soccer program, has just had this long-term plan of success, and they've been building and building and building the World Cup in 94, the creation of MLS in 96, the integration of now developmental leagues as well as a Major League Soccer league. It's like sort of the sky is the limit possibility. Where are we now is the real mm-hmm. question. And that happens every 4 years at the World Cup because we are now expected to mm-hmm. qualify. Beyond expecting to qualify, we are beginning to be in that class of soccer nation where we are also expected to get out of the first round.
Mm-hmm.
And this is a good draw for us. If mm-hmm. we can prove ourselves against England,
mm-hmm.
We should be able to handle Slovenia and Algeria.
Mm-hmm. That's my impression of the group, of course. As for the makeup of the U.S. team and how they will approach England, I expect they will primarily be absorbing England, which could be tricky because the team is, on balance, stronger on offense than it is on defense. And, however, absorbing an attack, they showed in the Confederations Cup, in a flash, this team has the skill to counterattack beautifully, and counterattack where the ball ends up in the back of the net. So it could be an exciting match, and at the same time, they could be overmatched, I think, by the British side. So it could go one way or the other. I don't expect, however, the United States to, say, have the balance of play. That's one thing I wouldn't expect in the game.
That's true. I mean, the strength of the United States has always been basically from the goalkeeper forward. Right. You start with a great keeper. And you get a good defense, an organized defense. They might not be individually tactically superior, but they're organized. You see a lot of rotations by the fullbacks. There's a lot of cover. The midfield tends to be disciplined in terms of marking. And the one thing that the United States has always lacked is that true creative spark that could blow a game open. But they're also good on set pieces, which will get you that goal or two.
Right. I think now with Donovan and Dempsey still, and then they have a good supporting cast around them on offense who can play along with them. But first of all, Dempsey, yeah, occasionally he'll just trip over himself and he'll look sort of messy. But boy, he has spark sometimes that it puts the ball in the back of the net. And then Donovan sees the field beautifully, just very beautifully.
It's true. They actually have a more balanced, creative team than they've ever had. In fact, some of their weaknesses might be seen in the back line. So it's very unusual for the United States. This team.
Now, when I think about the United States, again, in the other framing of the show, which has to do with, again, political, cultural, economic subtext, the main point is, of course, the paradoxical relationship of American exceptionalism. And what's going on this month, even though this is in South Africa, there's 9-hour time difference from the West Coast to South Africa, 6 from the East Coast. It seems that this is the biggest World Cup ever. That globalization of sport, and the way in which America would have had the biggest money, sort of unique sports culture in the world around baseball, basketball, and football. Now soccer is penetrating it. This is relating then to the ways in which America is having to become part of the world, not the sole superpower, not exceptional in sports with a different sports culture. So I find that dynamic very interesting. And, of course, now the largest group of fans, at least as of a few weeks ago, it might have changed at the last minute, who knows, it would be hard to keep track of, but one of the largest groups of fans for sure has come from the United States to South Africa.
Well, I think that just goes back to the fact that they've begun to win. I mean, people in the United States are only attracted to winners. I mean, it's a cliche, but it's true. If you're not winning, they're not going to pay attention. But the other thing about soccer is that it, unlike the other every 4 year sporting event, the Olympics, there are no real Olympic fans, but there are soccer fans.
Mm.
And now there are more venues and more outlets for a fan in the United States to participate, whether it's watching a game in Europe, whether it's going to see your child on Saturday morning. So it just grows and grows and grows.
Well, I do. I actually will counter that a little bit and say that I think it is a little bit more than that. I think if when you do look at stuff like blue state, red state America, right? Red state America, I mean, obviously this is massive generalization. Clint Dempsey comes from Texas, right?
Yeah.
But red state America goes back to the traditions of American nativism, exclusivity, non-integration into a cosmopolitan global community. And blue state America is increasingly a part of that global community, and this was reflected in the election of Barack Obama. Now, this doesn't mean that, you know, I'm completely embracing the politics of blue state America or Obamaism, but I do think that those general trends are true, and I think they see the spectacularly beautiful global soccer culture that is it's both the sport on the field's so exciting, and the culture's very sophisticated, and there's an incredible attraction there, and the barriers that have existed in American sports culture to exclude global soccer are breaking down.
Absolutely, and I think that goes straight to the demographic change in the United States as well.
Right,
I think
sure.
The reactionary forces of white Anglo-Saxon Protestant America see a certain amount of Hispanicness to soccer, which goes right into the fears of a lot of the immigration policies that are going on in the United States. And yeah, I think if you want to break it down, blue state, red state, in terms of the sporting culture, there's a reactionary force from the ingrained NFL, Major League Baseball, NBA, to this thing that, and it's not like it, when they see themselves generally, they see themselves as this amazingly huge thing. We're the biggest sport. The Super Bowl is the biggest event. But what they also see is just over the border is this tidal wave of sporting fanaticism, and it surrounds them. You know, if it only took over Canada, then it would be completely surrounded.
Hey, Steve Nash wrote the intro to the World Cup guide from ESPN, Canadian Steve Nash, whose brother played on the Canadian team and who is a huge fan of Tottenham Hotspurs.
That's right. And with Montreal and Vancouver coming into the MLS, I think it is only a matter of time before. And I think that culture is actually a lot more acceptable as a former Commonwealth.
Well, one of the things, too, is for someone like myself who understands when teams in the rest of the world root against the USA. They do it in the Olympics, and they do it because America's the sole superpower. It's the economic hegemon, cultural hegemon, the imperialist nation, etc. In soccer, I grew up, of course, dreaming of being on the one national side I could be on, which was the United States, and playing in the World Cup. I don't say this often on the show, but I played competitively through my first year of college.
As did I.
And I dreamed of being on the team, and I've never really viewed the soccer team because it was not, you know, the big muscled American exceptionalist force of other American sporting sides, that it was something that I felt could be embraced even if someone was going to say, damn you, Yankee imperialist.
I have two little stories from when I was in Germany during the last World Cup that I think pretty much epitomizes this. First was when we were playing in Italy. There was a huge street carnival, as there always is before a World Cup game. And there were all these American fans. Now, most of the American fans that I'd seen at the first game in Schalke, we kind of knew who they were. They were the regular Sam's Army crowd. You kind of seen them before. But now there was all these other people, and they all seemed to have very close-shaved heads. And they were really reveling in the fact that they could wear an American flag. And so we started talking to them as part of this documentary I was doing, and they were saying, well, you know, we are not allowed to show our Americanness off the base normally. This is the first time we can. And they didn't know anything about soccer. Afterwards, at the after party, sort of on the street, you know, they were all saying, oh, my God, I this is the greatest thing in the world. I wish we had this in the United States.
Right.
Then the other thing was against Ghana in Nuremberg.
Mm.
There was this kind of a big street party as we were on our way to the stadium, which is kind of out in the burbs. And there was one sign that just kind of got me as to what this really means. And it was a huge sign that said, U.S. out of Iraq and into the second round. And it was kind of unfortunate, but I think that kind of shows what soccer can do, that it can bring in these diverse opinions and diverse communities. And sure, it's a little bit nationalistic, but it doesn't mean it has to be jingoistic.
Right.
You know?
Right. And the team is one of, if not the most diverse team ethnically in the tournament.
I don't know, France.
No, but in terms of it may have the majority of players might be white American, but to a lesser degree than other teams, but just the range of ethnic diversities that are represented. Generally, it's the most diverse because there was Brian Chang, there were Latino American players, there were African American players, right? And again, of course, a diversity of white Americans who are from different ethnicities.
That's right. And different, not just ethnicities, but you talked about Dempsey from Nacogdoches, just basically from lower middle income. And this has always been seen as an upper class suburban sport. But the real revelation in the last, I'd say, 6 or 7 years in the United States national team was the inclusiveness of the Hispanic player. And there could be many books and movies made about how the U.S. soccer was a white, upper-class, East Coast-controlled group. And most of Southwest United States, unless you went through UCLA, you were excluded from possibility of joining the Olympic developmental program and other such programs. Now you're seeing, you know, primarily Paco Torres, Francisco Torres, who plays in Mexico, also from Texas. But that his kind of creative spark, you know, he went straight to the pros. He didn't go through college. But that kind of player was usually overlooked. And that's adding a whole new dimension, this controlling, creative midfielder. And that's why I think once that community is more embraced within the U.S. soccer, and it is changing, then I think we'll really be a force to be reckoned with, because that is our biggest, most passionate population of soccer fans in the United States is the Hispanic community.
Well, it's going to be fun tomorrow, and I don't expect the passion, however, in Southern California for Team USA that was exhibited today for the Mexican national side. But at the same time, I think people will be watching, and I do think that success in the tournament will elevate the status of the game like never before, because I think when I just go on to Yahoo.com, when I go on to news.google.com, when I look at the major newspapers, this thing is playing larger than I've ever seen it play before in the United States.
And it only get bigger.
Indeed. Well, thank you, Pablo. And up next, we're going to be looking at the Greece versus South Korea match, which takes place in a few hours. But we're going to look at it in the way we do here on The People's Game, by talking about the political situations in both countries and how the World Cup tournament can impact them. And welcome back to The People's Game. This is Alan Minsky. And tomorrow's first match is one that isn't receiving all that much attention in the United States, South Korea versus Greece, but it is a very interesting match in that South Korea in 2002 and Greece, respectively, in 2004, completely captured the world of soccer's attention. In 2002, South Korea made an unexpected run to the semifinals. In 2004, just as unexpectedly, the Greek team, huge underdogs, won the European Championship in huge series of upsets, including in the final over Portugal in a game at Portugal. Well, Greece and South Korea are also important for this show because they're two of the hot spots politically in the world right now. And I have on the phone to talk about Greece, Savas Michael Matsas. He is an oncologist, a philosopher, author of many books, and one of the lead organizers of EEK, an odd acronym in English, but it is a radical left organization in Greece. And in recent weeks and months, Greece has been in a huge social crisis as the economy has gone down a sinkhole and there have been massive social protests. So it's in this context that the Greek national soccer team, which by all appearances rallied the nation spectacularly in 2004, takes the field tomorrow in the World Cup in South Africa versus South Korea. So, Savas Michael Matsas, what, if anything, does the Greek national soccer team mean to Greece in its current social crisis?
There will be a lot of interest, I think, tomorrow by seeing the match. But the context is totally changed in relation to 2004.
Right.
In 2004, the whole enthusiasm here was connected also with the old artificial atmosphere created in that period of time in relation to the coming Olympic Games in Athens. Of course, 6 years later, the Olympic Games the organization of the Olympic Games in Athens has proven to be a big bubble, which exacerbated the debt of the country and the current enormous crisis of indebtedness. So nobody now thinks about the Olympic Games in the same way at that time, and nobody today thinks about the victory of the Greek soccer team in 2004 as that time. But that does not mean that there will be no interest, there will be no support by the fans, including by me. I will see in my TV screen what will happen. But that there is no, the whole psychology of the people has changed. Particularly, we live through very difficult times, and no nationalistic exploitation of this event can divert the attention of the people for the real dramatic situation in which we are plunging now, and the coming struggles will be much, much bigger than what we knew before. Everybody here is preparing for the real battle, who will be not in South Africa stadiums, but here in the streets of Athens and all the major cities of Greece. This is how we see the things.
Now, it is an interesting thing. Now, the Greek team are huge underdogs in this tournament. They, of course, were huge underdogs in 2004. Just to focus on the field for a second, does anybody believe that this Greek team has much of a chance to go deep into the tournament this year?
There are hopes, but I think the whole structure of soccer in Greece is undermined. Despite the victory of 2004, the 2004 victory was used, exploited, over-exploited, overused for political reasons, of all ideological reasons in any sense. But the needs to develop soccer as a real sport were not met. All these big business people owning our football teams in this country, all these ship owners, these bankers, all these people who are responsible for what happens now to us, and they ask us to pay for their crisis and what they do, that we rescue their banks and their big business, these are the people who control the Greek soccer and are responsible for the bad shape, because we have to admit we have bad shape, and I don't see why, although I would like to see any chance to go very far, at least this year.
Well, I want to thank you so much for joining us. It is a very, very unique situation in Greece, but one that could be replicated in many countries, not only throughout Europe, but across the world. And certainly what you said about the role that the 2004 Olympics had in Athens and then the coming Greek bubble. Perhaps the South Africans themselves should be wary of that lesson. And my impression of the Greek team is they really succeeded in sneaking up on people. They played a very uncanny strategic tournament in 2004. But after that tournament, it was unlikely that they were going to sneak up on the great teams like they did that year. I want to thank you so much, Savas Michael Matsas.
Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. Take care and enjoy the match tomorrow, and good luck to the Greeks.
Thank you.
And welcome back. And as we mentioned before, Greece is taking on South Korea in the first match on the second day of the 2010 World Cup soccer tournament. And we just spoke to Savas Michael Matsas from Greece about how the Greek national team fits into a very dynamic, intense political and social situation in Greece. And right now I'm joined on the phone by Young-ho Kim, who is a Koreatown resident in Los Angeles, California. And the Korean Peninsula remains one of the major hotspots in the world. And of course, back in 2002, the world was riveted by the South Korean team's run into the semifinals, and they were also amazed by the unbelievable fan support that the South Korean side had during the tournament. In many respects, it rivals in the level of passion any exhibition of support that any team has ever received anywhere in the world. It simply blew the world away to watch the South Korean fans during the tournament. So Young-ho Kim, right now in the context of all that is going on between South and North Korea and in any aspect actually of the Korean-American experience or the Korean political situation writ large, what is the significance of the World Cup tournament and the South Korean team's appearance in the 2010 World Cup?
I think in Korea, there's a long tradition of the mainstream doing something and then everyone needs to do it, whatever it is. So it might be everyone thinking, oh, the literature is okay and, you know, to follow suit. Or everyone saying, oh, we all need to be into this competitive college entrance environment. And back in 02, the big thing was the World Cup, and it was, oh, everyone needs to be a patriot and everyone needs to, you know, be cheering for Korea. And in the 90s, when I was in high school, you know, you get excited to think that I was cheering for Korea back in 1994. Mm-hmm. In 02, I generally thought, you know, there are more important things in general. And I think I was just sleeping the night Korea was playing against Italy, I think.
Mm-hmm.
And I think I was sleeping at my younger brother's dorm room after visiting my brother. He was in this high school dorm. My parents were visiting there.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, people were yelling and saying, oh, Korea, go! Almost near here! And then people run over me and they're like, yo, you know, you need to be awake because this is very important. And at some point in there, I get the sense that, especially my mother, who was asking me to come and wake up and sit in front of the TV, that she felt that there's going to be bad repercussions for my younger brother who was living there if I wasn't excited, if I didn't show up as excited as the other people. Like, how do you call that? It's the, you know, people taking revenge against the other people for not being part of the group.
Mm-hmm.
I thought that was very unhealthy in general and overall. And unfortunately, the World Cup, I think it generally happens during the summer.
Right.
And in the case of Korea, there's always the regional elections and the general elections happening during summer, and then the presidential one normally happens, I think, in either in February or November.
Mm-hmm.
And during the general elections, it's always when the general sentiment of the population around a certain party, depending on regardless of which party it is, they might have supported the party during the presidential elections, but after seeing their policies and role, a feedback comes through in the form of a voting against that party during the general elections or during the regional elections. And unfortunately, whenever the war happens, that just swallows up every issue. So back in 2002, it was the story of the two junior high students, Hyunsunyi and Misunyi, who were run over by U.S. Army Humvee.
Right.
I think it was either a Humvee or an APC. And there were some candidate vigils and saying, oh my God, you know, we need to ask for responsibility from the U.S. Army. And the war can happen, everything, people forget about everything. And right now what's going on in Korea is there's the issue of the Chonan, I think the Chonan ship.
Right.
Which was a mysterious sunk, and there's some concerns about, you know, did the government do everything to, the South Korean government do everything to actually reveal the cost of it? Or is there something more problematic going on, such as one thing could be the Navy not taking care enough of their ships, so allowing people to be in danger ships? Or even maybe this being a misfiring from some of the naval trainings that are happening nearby, the US, Korea, I think, and Japan joint training. The conservative Grand National Party government tried to portray that as, look, you know, the communists, the North Korea has attacked us and we need to be on guard. And it was, for most people in Korea, it was revealed that a lot of the proofs, I don't know if you're familiar with the Chonan ship incident.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of the proofs that the Korean government showed us, this is proof that the North Korean government used it. One of them, the most hilarious one, was claiming that inside of the torpedo debris that they found in the ocean, there's a big bright writing, handwritten note saying number one. And for the Korean government, South Korean government says, oh look, you know, this is proof of North Korea has a tradition of writing their torpedo serial numbers in by hand. And of course, it's been sunk there for months and in the ocean for months. And of course, the writing would have not washed away. It's very clear. For a lot of people, that was very suspicious. And it seemed like it was made up proof. And that sentiment was building up towards elections. And the election showed the Grand National Party lost a bunch of seats in the regional council, in the city council seats, a bunch of, what's this called, regional governor's seats. And you have the impact of that would have extended over the elections. But now the World Cup came, I mean, a lot of the people are going to forget about this, you know, celebrate. And after the World Cup is over, they'll come back and be like, oh, you know, great, we made up to the 16,
right,
the semifinals, and go back to their lives. So it's too bad that that political momentum is lost after each World Cup season comes around.
Now, is there, and we only have a couple minutes left, but I suppose I have two more questions for you. One is certainly the fervor around the cup, the World Cup, can't be as great when it's not in Korea. But in 2006 and now in 2010, do you anticipate that there will be scenes at times that approximate what there was in 2002, both in Korea and in Koreatown? By the way, in 2002, I actually attended the semifinal match with Germany in a mall in Koreatown, and it was the middle of the night here, and it was packed with people chanting. It was really one of the most amazing scenes I've ever been at. But will it, since the tournament is not in Korea, certainly it can't have quite that level of response, but does it approximate that?
Yeah, I mean, I just, when I was coming home just now, I biked across the Radio Korea lawn,
right,
in Wishan Western. They already had the cheerleaders, like 10 cheerleaders had a big booming music, and they're already prepping up for the 4 a.m. Game, which is going to start in 8 hours.
Right, sure, right.
So, yeah, it seems to be the case. And the World Cup fever always seems to be building up in Korea as well. It's just flooding the... I follow what's going on in Korea a lot through blogs and Twitter.
Mm-hmm.
And it's just overflowing. And some people are already saying, oh, you know, I wish the Korean team just lost right away and came back home so that we can get back to politics.
Well,
and, you know, they're getting backlash by people who are excited about the games and so forth.
But now the second...
Yeah, I think there's a lot of excitement in the community.
Well, and of course, the second question and last question, again, we only have a couple minutes left here, is the aspect of North Korea being in the tournament this time. What added element has that brought to this tournament in terms of, you know, the global Korean community, or rather the global South Korean community, both expats and in South Korea? What dimension does that add to this tournament for South Koreans and South Korean expatriates?
In general, I haven't seen that be an issue.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think it's an issue, but in general, like, even among all generally conservative, anti-communist people, they feel it's just sports. And a lot of people who cheer, who root for in the World Cup, they either root for both North Korea and South Korea. They think, oh, you know, it's still Korea, so let's root for both.
Right.
Or some people who might have, feel against it, they just choose not to root for, but they don't go against it or anything. I can't quite explain myself, but yeah.
You know, so that makes perfect
the
sense.
The usual North Korea bashing is not something to press in the World Cup.
Well, and of course, North Korea has a very high-profile match simply because they open up with the tournament favorites on Tuesday. Mm-hmm. And lastly, with all that you just said, will you watch the match tomorrow, and will you watch the match on Tuesday?
No, I think I'm just going to read the newspaper articles.
It is very early in the morning. Well, anyway, look, thank you for the insight into the Korean community here in Southern California and in Korea. We've been speaking with Young-ho Kim, who is a resident of Koreatown here in Los Angeles, and thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
And that is the end of our Marathon The People's Game for June 11th, 2010, the day in which global soccer has liberated the masses. We've broken the chains, and now it ain't nothing but joy for the next 29 days. Yeah. rock and roll.